So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. As I promised all Coburns on the show today, in half an hour, I'll play the interview I recorded Friday afternoon with Patrick about the Turkish elections and the war with the Islamic State and all this and that. But first up right now live is his brother Andrew Coburn, author of Kill Chain, about the drone wars, and before that, Rumsfeld, his rise, fall, and catastrophic legacy, and a whole lot of other books besides that. And I mentioned to you earlier, and I like mentioning this all the time, that the first real serious political book I read when I was in 10th grade was Out of Control, about Iran-Contra by Andrew's wife, Leslie, which really helped inform my point of view a lot as a young kid. Anyway, welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Andrew?
Hey, great to be with you. I'm doing fine.
Good. Very happy to have you here. And man, I'm really sorry. I'm looking at the Amazon page now, and I could get, I actually just ordered the book, The Threat, Inside the Soviet Military Machine. They got them for a penny.
Yeah, good bargain, good deal.
Very good deal. I mean, believe me, I know it was 20 bucks and worth every penny back in the 1980s, but that was when it came out. Was when? What year was it? 83?
82.
Oh, 82 even. Yeah, it says 83 here, but so yeah, very early on in the Reagan presidency here. And so anyway, I got an email from a guy that said he had just read this and he wanted me to interview you about it. And I wish I'd gotten on the ball and ordered the book right then. But so I haven't read it, but I did just read all the reviews of it on Amazon.com. And I like the one where the guy says, I read this book and rolled on the floor laughing. It is so very believable.
That's good.
He wasn't laughing at you. He was laughing because he believed you. He thought you were right. So now, in 1982, I was just a little kid. I was in first grade. But I remember, it was brinksmanship, and it was the Reagan years, and detente was off, and the Cold War was back on. And more or less the way I learned it was that their empire was as powerful as ours, and that we are going to be at permanent standoff for the foreseeable future. And I don't know whether you outright predicted the complete demise of their system in this book or not. I wouldn't be surprised if you did, but you sure seem to be seeing right through all the propaganda, the conventional wisdom, as I was exposed to it at the time, all the way through, huh?
Well, that's right. I mean, actually, you've got one thing slightly wrong. We weren't told that their empire was equal to ours. We were told that it was maybe stronger, and that unless we spent ourselves into bankruptcy in a hurry, they would be all over us, and there'd be, you know, we'd be under a communist system before you could turn around. In fact, there was a, do you remember a movie called Red Dawn? Actually, it was pretty good, about the Russians invading the U.S.
Oh, yeah, around. I loved it when I was a kid.
It was a great film, great film. But that was the general, that was the official ethos. I mean, it really got going in the mid-70s. It'd been going forever since about 1948. But it ratcheted up in the mid-70s, coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, as the Vietnam War ended, and there was somewhere, you know, the military-industrial complex had to find some other way to justify its enormous income. So that's when they started ratcheting up the Soviet threat, and we were told that the Soviets could actually do a first strike, could actually win a nuclear war with a first strike, unless we spent an incredible amount of money having a mobile ICBM, the MX, which was going to drive up and down the interstates, this ICBM. There were all sorts of other things. And I set out I thought this is kind of ridiculous, you know, that the Russia is, you know, many estimable aspects to it, but it was a poor country, compared to the US. And how come we're told on the one hand that communism doesn't work? You know, it's a hopeless system and it'll never work. On the other hand, it somehow has produced this incredible military machine where they have, in Ronald Reagan's immortal words, more missiles, bigger missiles, better missiles than we have. I remember him saying that. And that their planes work better and their soldiers are taller and stronger and everything else is better unless we, you know, really strive harder and pay much more, give much more money to Lockheed and people like that. Mm-hmm. So I set out to look out, you know, to see what was really going on. And at that time, there was a huge influx of Russian immigrants into New York, where I was living at the time. And I started talking to them, and it's left a part of this deal in the 70s. They'd let a lot of people, a lot of Jewish Russians or Jewish Soviets out around in the 70s. And a lot of them, they all had to say they were going to Israel, but the moment they got out, most of them wanted to come to New York very reasonably. And so I started interviewing them. Of course, all the males had been in the army, conscription in Russia, a little recognized fact over here at the time. So I started talking to them about their military experiences. And they all said to a man, it's a complete shambles. You know, nothing works. We were hardly trained at all. Everyone's drunk all the time. All the weapons break down all the time. You know, it was more or less as you might expect.
Yeah. So my father-in-law was in the Red Army in Afghanistan.
No kidding. What did he say?
Well, they had one pair of boots to share among everybody.
Oh, man.
You know, they're freezing their asses off and mostly sitting around getting high and doing nothing.
There you go. I mean, for instance, there was a plane they had called the MiG-25, which was meant to be this wonder plane that would, you know, just outclass, fly us into the ground. I mean, it was going to be the cutting edge of the communist menace. And then a Soviet Red Army, Red Air Force pilot defected, Viktor Belenko, he was called. And he landed in Japan with this plane. It turned out to be very inconvenient because it turned out this plane was pretty much of a dog. And, you know, it ran out of gas almost immediately, couldn't maneuver. It was hopeless in so many ways. But the thing I liked that he reported, which I had in the book, which is that the hydraulics, you know, along with the gasoline it used alcohol as sort of a pure alcohol, I think in the hydraulics or... And so that meant that every MiG-25 base stank of gasoline, of jet fuel, because they drain off the alcohol to drink. But to keep the book straight, if you used, you know, X amount of alcohol, you had to have used Y amount of jet fuel. So to keep the book straight, they just poured the jet fuel into the ditch. And so the whole base stank of jet fuel. Because they've been drinking all the, that was just one example among hundreds I came across. My favorite one, which got a lot of play here at the time, was the automatic loader on the main gun of the T-72 tank. And, you know, this was invoked, you know, the Soviets are so far ahead of us. Man, we have to load the shells into our tank guns by hand. They have an automatic loader that does it automatically, which therefore, you know, sounded like a better. And what I found out was that a thing had an unfortunate habit of loading not just the shell, or sometimes the shell, and sometimes the gunner's arm into the gun. So you had a lot of one-armed T-72 gunners in the Red Army armored division. So, I mean, the whole point of this exercise was not to denigrate the Soviet Union, but to point out how we were being fed lies. I mean, the military knew all this perfectly well. This was no, I mean, I got most of my stuff from, you know, from the military here.
Sure. Yeah, the bomber gap and the missile gap. And this is the whole history of the whole Cold War is some made up gap or another just to cash welfare checks for millionaires. That's all.
Right. Exactly right. It was all a lie. And it was a lie. And I also found, by the way, that the Soviet military, meanwhile, were telling lies about us. So it was these, like, you know, it's got the image of these two sort of fat drunks propping each other up. And the one big mistake, the huge error I made in my thinking, I did kind of say this couldn't last, you know, how decrepit their system was. But the big mistake I made in my thinking was, well, once the Soviet Union goes away, if this all, you know, if they collapse, then this, you know, the scam won't work here anymore. And that's where I was dead wrong.
Yeah, no, Saddam will fill in fine. South American drug dealers, whatever you got. David Koresh.
Or even no one at all.
Yeah. You know?
Because they, you know, when they ran out of threats for the time being before Al-Qaeda appeared, they were talking about...
Pablo Escobar, yeah. Hey, wait, hold it right there. Hold it right there, Andrew. We'll be right back after this, y'all. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network here, libertyradionetwork.com. LRN.FM, live, noon to 2 on the weekdays. Join up the chat room, check out the archives, all that stuff at scotthorton.org. All right, I'm in the middle of talking with Andrew Coburn. He is the author of the new book, Kill Chain, about the drone wars, and before that, Rumsfeld, his rise, fall, and catastrophic legacy, which is so great. You gotta read that book, man. Anyway, we're talking about this one that he wrote way back in the 1980s, in the early 1980s, 1982. You can get it for a penny right now, guys. They got 63 of them used, 34, in paperback and in hardback, 34 paperback for a penny right now, guys. At Amazon.com, The Threat, Inside the Soviet Military Machine. And what a complete piece of junk it was. And so at the break, I just made up the last part. So at the break, we were talking about, I'm sorry, I was stepping all over you as we were going out to break there. Andrew, you were trying to say something making fun of the lack of an American enemy for the military-industrial complex after the unexpected by them dissolution of the Soviet Union and how they were trying to make do before Osama bin Laden there.
Right, right. You mentioned people like Pablo Escobar. Quite right. I mean, what they said, I remember the phrase, the jargon phrase that crept in was asymmetric non-peer competitor, non-peer competitor. And that meant, you know, the island of Grenada. Well, that was Grenada was earlier, but that meant some jerk on a street corner.
Manuel Noriega for a minute. And then, of course, Saddam Hussein made the perfect whipping boy for all of what Americans consider peacetime through the 1990s, but sure as hell wasn't for the people of Iraq then.
Well, that's right. He was a big threat at the same time thanks to us, the country was starving to death, you know. Happy days are here again, though, because we've got the Russian threat back, sort of. I mean, you know, if you listen to the way that the, you know, you should really listen to what the generals are saying, like Dunford, this new chairman of the joint, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He's very scary. He wants to send heavy weapons to Ukraine. They're amping up. They're sending, you know, more troops to Europe. And I've been told that, you know, suddenly the military has turned a lot more aggressive, you know, in Washington, demanding greater say in policy, of course, more money, and just generally throwing a weight around in a way they haven't done, hadn't been doing recently. Mm.
Yeah, well, in fact, going back, I guess I probably interviewed you about this at the time. You had a blog at Harper's Magazine about the sheer joy. There's no point in hiding it. There's no secret, dark, smoky room where the secret society conspires. It's just a meeting of lobbyists, of arms dealers, saying three cheers for the new Cold War. All right, guys.
That's right. That's right. They're so happy. The champagne corks apart. Yeah, I did. We were talking about this before. A source of mine who was at a meeting of defense contractor lobbyists, and I asked him what the mood was, and he said borderline euphoric.
Yeah.
Ukraine's looking good. Now we got, you know, now, I mean, did you see this piece in the story about, you know, Obama sending special forces troops to Syria?
Sure.
And the New York Times, in its article on this, sort of halfway down, it said, this could pose problems if they bomb U.S. troops. Well, the American soldiers are meant to be miles away. I mean, theory, on the ISIS front. But here it sounds like they'll be with, the moderate CIA-backed rebels, as they're called, that the Russians are bombing.
Yeah, that's a lie. That's working directly with the al-Nusra front that's still sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Exactly so.
No threat, right? There's no threat of – nobody ever thought the Russians were going to be bombing Syrian Kurdistan. So, it sounds exactly like that must be what the Times was alluding to there.
Well, yeah, this was kind of interesting. No one told us that. But there you go. Yeah, no, it's I'd say, things are looking good for the military-industrial complex, which is a concept people ought to use more often. As the this budget deal that was just announced with great fanfare and acclaim in the press, that's a lot more money for them. Less money for old folks on Social Security and Medicare, but hey, someone's got to pay for all this.
Well, it's always $1 trillion a year. Robert Higgs at the Independent Institute and the guys at Mother Jones and the National Priorities Project, all of those at least, and I'm sure there are more, have added it all up. And when you include the money for the nukes and everything else, it's easily $1 trillion a year for the cost.
You really ought to add in the VA too.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I think that's in there, including the cost of VA. Yeah.
Yeah, $1 trillion a year is about right. Yep. Yeah, I think it was Winslow Wheeler. I think of the
sure. Yeah, there was another one.
He did it first, I think. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and of course, it can fluctuate within maybe a couple of $10 billion, and then we get to hear him cry out loud about how it's the weakest army we've had since before World War I or whatever.
Well, that's right. That's right. Exactly. So, I mean, this outrageous thing that's going on where they're trying to eliminate the one airplane, the Air Force has, that is actually of some military use, the A-10.
Right.
And they want to do that because it'll save $4 billion a year. I mean, that's what they spend on their executive jets.
Yeah, and then so they'll have more of an excuse for needing the F-35. Well, now that we don't have the A-10 anymore, how are we supposed to provide any ground support at all? You got to give us more F-35s.
Forget the F-35. We're really off the races now with the new bomber, the B-3, which they've they were just announcing the contract for, even though it doesn't exist. It hasn't been built. There's no prototype. We don't know what it looks like. It's all secret. And yet they're already committed to spending $80 billion, which, multiplied that by 10. And they're going to immediately start shoveling contracts to the shoving out the contracts before the thing is even properly designed, because they want to get so many congressional districts sort of tied into this that it'll be impossible ever to cancel. So,
all right, now, but hang on here, Andrew. Let me play devil's PR man here for a second. Obviously, everybody knows that NATO expansion and America's nefarious role in Syria and all this is that the Russians, I'm not justifying anything they're doing, but they are clearly reacting to the American empire here. But let's go back to the 1980s for a second, because back then there really was a USSR, and it really did control, it was the hugest country in pure landmass in world history, of course, a massive empire occupying all of Central Asia and Eastern Europe. And all the criticisms of your book on Amazon say, yeah, but you're missing the point, Andrew Coburn. And the point is that even if their tanks were pieces of crap, they had so many of them. One guy says they considered their troops to be as expendable as ammunition, the way our side looks at ammunition. So it wasn't a fair fight when it came to the numbers and or the way that they would be used. And so, and in fact, I'll add one more thing to that. I know a guy used to make nukes for the U.S. government. And what he told me was back then that they thought that, man, you could have however many thousands of tanks pouring through the Fulda Gap, and America would never be able to stop them without nukes. They could conquer all of Western Europe, and it was nuclear fusion keeping them at bay. That was why he woke up in the morning and went and did his job, to protect freedom from them. He believed in it, and he's no dummy. He knows how to make nukes. So, maybe there was more of a threat there than you're letting on.
I disagree. First of all, we know now that they now, you know, they had no intention of pouring through the Fulda Gap or anywhere else. I didn't talk about intentions in the book because that was always the argument. I pointed out, in fact, that, you know, those huge tank numbers were mostly a myth. I mean, they had a lot of tanks, but most of them didn't work so good, and quite a lot of them didn't work at all. You know, they talked about the incredible number of Soviet army divisions that, you know, it's been a long time. It's been 35 years since I wrote this stuff.
Sure.
But, you know, that they had hundreds of divisions and we had practically no one, you know, a miserable 15 or 20 divisions or something. But I point out, you know, they had category one, their divisions were broken down into three categories, one, two, and three. And it turned out that category three divisions basically were a flag and an outhouse, which, you know, in the event of total war, they'd be mobilized and put into action. But that was going to take months and months. Category two divisions weren't much better. And category one divisions, despite all they were cracked up to be, you know, even we found out, I said, look, they aren't what they're cracked up to be. First of all, there aren't as many of them as people say. Secondly, they're all under strength. And thirdly, they're not really that well trained. I mean, and we that was confirmed when the wall came down and you could actually go and visit, you know, the cracked unit of all, which was the 20th Guards Army. It was the crack division stationed in East Germany outside Berlin. And they were all busy selling their belt buckles and caps to buy food. So this was the great, you know, knife that was poised at the throat of Western Europe. Not really. So yeah, that people still, you know, that was the old, you know, the fallback argument for the military industrial complex. Once you show that the planes and tanks weren't so great, they'd say, oh, but there's so many of them. But, you know, you had to look at really was there so many, and then so many of what, you know,
right.
So I rested my case then. It's still resting.
I see. All right. Yep. I'll buy that. Hey, listen, I'm sorry I kept you over time and I got to let you go so I can start your brother's interview on time here in just 1 second. But thank you very much for your time again on the show, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Okay. You're welcome. Take care.
All right. So that is Andrew Coburn. He wrote Kill Chain and a whole mess of other great books, including The Threat Inside the Soviet Military Machine back in 1982. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.